Do you feel a shiver up your spine from fear? Yes, it's another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind. Amp up your imagination and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. The Fortunes of Sir Robert Ardagh by J. Sheridan Le Fanu. In the south of Ireland and on the borders of the county of Limerick, there lies a district of 2 or 3 miles in length which is rendered interesting by the fact that it is one of the very few spots throughout this country in which some vestiges of aboriginal forests still remain. It has little or none of the lordly character of the American forest, where the axe has felled its oldest and its grandest trees. But in the close wood which survives live all the wild and pleasing peculiarities of nature. Its complete irregularity, its vistas, in whose perspective the quiet cattle are browsing, its refreshing glades, where the grey rocks arise from amid the nodding fern, the silvery shafts of the old birch trees, the knotted trunks of the hoary oak, the grotesque but graceful branches which never shed their honours under the tyrant pruning hook, the soft green sward, the checkered light and shade, the wild luxuriant weed, the lichen and the moss. All are beautiful alike in the green freshness of spring, or in the sadness and sere of autumn. Their beauty is of that kind which makes the heart full with joy, appealing to the affection with a power which belongs to nature only. This wood runs up from below the base to the ridge of a long line of irregular hills, having perhaps in primitive times formed but the skirting of some mighty forest which occupied the level below. But now, alas, whither have we drifted? Whither has the tide of civilization borne us? It has passed over land unprepared for it. It has left nakedness behind it. We have lost our forest, but our marauders remain. We have destroyed all that is picturesque, while we have retained everything that is revolting in barbarism. Through the midst of this woodland there runs a deep gully or glen, where the stillness of the scene is broken in upon by the brawling of a mountain stream, which, however, in the winter season swells into a rapid and formidable torrent. There is one point at which the glen becomes extremely deep and narrow. The sides descend to the depth of some 100 feet, and are so steep as to be nearly perpendicular. The wild trees have taken root in the crannies and chasms of the rock, are so intersected and entangled that one can with difficulty catch a glimpse of the stream, which wheels, flashes, and foams below as if exulting in the surrounding silence and solitude. This spot was not unwisely chosen as a point of no ordinary strength for the erection of a massive square tower or keep, one side of which rises as if in continuation of the precipitous cliff on which it is based. Originally, the only mode of ingress was by a narrow portal in the very wall which overtopped the precipice, opening upon a ledge of rock which afforded a precarious pathway, cautiously intersected, however, by a deep trench cut out with great labor in the living rock, so that in its pristine state, and before the introduction of artillery into the art of war, this tower might have been pronounced, and that not presumptuously, impregnable. The progress of improvement and the increasing security of the times had, however, tempted its successive proprietors, if not to adorn, at least to enlarge their premises. And about the middle of the last century, when the castle was last inhabited, the original square tower formed but a small part of the edifice. The castle and a wide tract of the surrounding country had from time immemorial belonged to a family which, for distinctness, we shall call by the name of Ardagh. And owing to the associations which, in Ireland, almost always attach to scenes which have long witnessed alike the exercise of stern feudal authority and of that savage hospitality which distinguished the good old times, this building has become the subject and the scene of many wild and extraordinary traditions. One of them I have been enabled by a personal acquaintance with an eyewitness of the events. to trace to its origin, and yet it is hard to say whether the events which I am about to record appeared more strange and improbable as seen through the distorting medium of tradition, or in the appalling dimness of uncertainty which surrounds the reality. Tradition says that sometime in the last century Sir Robert Ardagh, a young man, and the last heir of that family, went abroad and served in foreign armies, and that having acquired considerable honor and emolument, he settled at Castle Ardagh, the building we have just now attempted to describe. He was what the country people call a dark man, that is, he was considered morose, reserved, and ill-tempered, and as it was supposed from the utter solitude of his life, was upon no terms of cordiality with the other members of his family. The only occasion upon which he broke through the solitary monotony of his life was during the continuance of the racing season, and immediately subsequent to it, at which time he was to be seen among the busiest among the course, betting deeply and unhesitatingly, and invariably with success. Sir Robert was, however, too well known as a man of honor, and of too high a family, to be suspected of any unfair dealing. He was, moreover, a soldier, and a man of intrepid as well as of haughty character, and no one cared to hazard a surmise, the consequences of which would be felt, most probably, by its originator only. Gossip, however, was not silent. It was remarked that Sir Robert never appeared at the race ground, which was the only place of public resort which he frequented, except in company with a certain strange-looking person, who was never seen elsewhere or under other circumstances. It was remarked, too, that this man, whose relation to Sir Robert was never distinctly ascertained, was the only person to whom he seemed to speak unnecessarily. It was observed that while with the country gentry, he exchanged no further communication than what was unavoidable in arranging his sporting transactions. With this person, he would converse earnestly and frequently. Tradition asserts that to enhance the curiosity which his unaccountable and exclusive preference excited, the stranger possessed some striking and unpleasant peculiarities of person and of garb, though it is not stated, however, what these were. But they, in conjunction with Sir Robert's secluded habits and extraordinary run of luck, a success which was supposed to result from the suggestions and immediate advice of the unknown, were sufficient to warrant report in pronouncing that there was something queer in the wind, and in surmising that Sir Robert was playing a fearful and a hazardous game, and that, in short, his strange companion was little better than the devil himself. Years rolled quietly away, and nothing very novel occurred in the arrangements of Castle Ardagh, excepting that Sir Robert parted with his odd companion, but as nobody could tell whence he came, so nobody could say whither he had gone. Sir Robert's habits, however, underwent no consequent change. He continued regularly to frequent the race meetings without mixing at all in the convivialities of the gentry, and immediately afterwards to relapse into the secluded monotony of his ordinary life. It was said that he had accumulated vast sums of money, and as his bets were always successful and always large, such must have been the case. He did not suffer the acquisition of wealth, however, to influence his hospitality or his housekeeping. He neither purchased land nor extended his establishment, and his mode of enjoying his money must have been altogether that of the miser, consisting merely in the pleasure of touching and telling his gold and the consciousness of wealth. Robert's temper, so far from improving, became more than ever gloomy and morose. He sometimes carried the indulgence of his evil disposition to such a height that it bordered upon insanity. During these paroxysms he would neither eat, drink, nor sleep. On such occasions he insisted on perfect privacy, even from the intrusion of his most trusted servants. His voice was frequently heard, sometimes in earnest supplication, sometimes raised, as if in loud and angry altercation with some unknown visitant. Sometimes he would for hours together walk to and fro throughout the long, oak-wainscoted apartment which he generally occupied, with wild gesticulations and agitated pace, in the manner of one who has been roused to a state of unnatural excitement by some sudden and appalling intimation. These paroxysms of apparent lunacy were so frightful that during their continuance even his oldest and most faithful domestics dared not approach him. Consequently, his hours of agony were never intruded upon, and the mysterious cause of his suffering appeared likely to remain hidden forever. On one occasion, a fit of this kind continued for an unusual time. The ordinary term of their duration, about 2 days, had been long past, and the old servant, who generally waited upon Sir Robert after these visitations, having in vain listened for the well-known tinkle of his master's handbell, began to feel extremely anxious. He feared that his master might have died from sheer exhaustion, or perhaps put an end to his own existence during his miserable depression. These fears at length became so strong that, having in vain urged some of his brother servants to accompany him, he determined to go up alone and himself see whether any accident had befallen Sir Robert. He traversed the several passages which conducted from the new to the more ancient parts of the mansion, and having arrived in the old hall of the castle, the utter silence of the hour, for it was very late in the night, the idea of the nature of the enterprise in which he was engaging himself, a sensation of remoteness from anything like human companionship, but more than all, the vivid but undefined anticipation of something horrible, came upon him with such oppressive weight that he hesitated as to whether he should proceed. Real uneasiness, however, respecting the fate of his master, for whom he felt that kind of attachment which the force of habitual intercourse not infrequently engenders respecting objects not in themselves amiable, and also latent unwillingness to expose his weakness to the ridicule of his fellow servants, combined to overcome his reluctance. He had just placed his foot upon the first step of the staircase which conducted to his master's chamber, when his attention was arrested by a low but distinct knocking at the hall door. Not perhaps very sorry at finding thus an excuse even for deferring his intended expedition, he placed the candle upon a stone block which lay in the hall and approached the door, uncertain whether his ears had not deceived him. This doubt was justified by the circumstance that the hall entrance had been for nearly 50 years disused as a mode of ingress to the castle. The situation of this gate also, which we have endeavored to describe, opening upon a narrow ledge of rock which overhangs a perilous cliff, rendered it at all times, but particularly at night, a dangerous entrance. This shelving platform of rock, which formed the only avenue to the door, was divided, as I have already stated, by a broad chasm, the planks across which had long disappeared by decay or otherwise, so that it seemed at least highly improbable that any man could have found his way across the passage in safety to the door, more particularly on a night like this of singular darkness. The old man, therefore, listened attentively to ascertain whether the first application should be followed by another. He had not long to wait. The same low but singularly distinct knocking was repeated, so low that it seemed as if the applicant had employed no harder or heavier instrument in his hand. And yet, despite the immense thickness of the door, with such strength that the sound was distinctly audible, the knock was repeated a third time, without any increase of loudness, and the old man, obeying an impulse for which, to his dying hour, he could never account, proceeded to remove one by one the three great oaken bars which had secured the door. Time and damp had effectually corroded the iron chambers of the lock, so that it afforded little resistance. With some effort, as he believed, assisted from without, the old servant succeeded in opening the door, and a low, square-built figure, apparently that of a man, wrapped in a large black cloak, entered the hall. The servant could not see much of this visitor with any distinctness. His dress appeared foreign. The skirt of his ample cloak was thrown over one shoulder. He wore a large felt hat with a very heavy leaf, from under which escaped what appeared to be a mass of long, sooty black hair. His feet were cased in heavy riding boots. Such were the few particulars which the servant had time and light to observe. The stranger desired him to let his master know instantly that a friend had come, by appointment, to settle some business with him. The servant hesitated, but a slight motion on the part of his visitor, as if to possess himself of the candle, determined him. So, taking it in his hand, he ascended the castle stairs, leaving the guest in the hall. On reaching the apartment which opened upon the oak chamber, he was surprised to observe the door of that room partly open, and the room itself lit up. He paused, but there was no sound. He looked in and saw Sir Robert, his head and the upper part of his body reclining on a table upon which two candles burned. His arms were outstretched forward on either side and perfectly motionless. It appeared that having been sitting at the table, he had thus sunk forward, either dead or in a swoon. There was no sound of breathing at all. Everything was silent except the sharp ticking of a watch which lay beside the lamp. The servant coughed twice or thrice, but with no effect. His fears now almost amounted to certainty, and he was approaching the table on which his master partly lay to satisfy himself of his death, when Sir Robert slowly raised his head, and throwing himself back in his chair, fixed his eyes in a ghastly and uncertain gaze upon his attendant. At length he said slowly and painfully, as if he dreaded the answer, "In God's name, what are you?" "Sir," said the servant, "a strange gentleman wants to see you below." At this intimation, Sir Robert, starting to his feet and tossing his arms wildly upward, uttered a shriek of such appalling and despairing terror that it was almost too fearful for human endurance, and long after the sound had ceased, it seemed to the terrified imagination of the old servant to roll through the deserted passages in bursts of unnatural laughter. After a few moments, Sir Robert said, "Can't you send him away? Why does he come so soon? O merciful powers, let him leave me for an hour, a little time. I can't see him now. Try to get him away. You see, I can't go down now. I have not strength. O God, O God, let him come back in an hour. It is not long to wait. He cannot lose anything by it. Nothing, nothing, nothing. Tell him that. Say anything to him." The servant went down. In his own words, he did not feel the stairs under him till he got to the hall. The figure stood exactly as he had left it. He delivered his master's message as coherently as he could. The stranger replied in a careless tone, "If Sir Robert will not come down to me, I must go up to him." The man returned, and to his surprise he found his master much more composed in manner. He listened to the message, and though the cold perspiration rose in drops upon his forehead faster than he could wipe it away, his manner had lost the dreadful agitation which had marked it before. He rose feebly and, casting a last look of agony behind him, passed from the room to the lobby, where he signed to his attendant not to follow him. The man moved as far as the head of the staircase, from whence he had a tolerably distinct view of the hall, which was imperfectly lighted by the candle he had left there. He saw his master reel rather than walk down the stairs, clinging all the way to the banisters. He walked on, as if about to sink every moment from weakness. The figure advanced as if to meet him, and in passing struck down the light. The servant could see no more, but there was a sound of struggling, renewed at intervals with silent but fearful energy. It was evident, however, that the parties were approaching the door, for he heard the solid oak sound twice or thrice, as the feet of the combatants, in shuffling hither and thither over the floor, struck upon it. After a slight pause, he heard the door thrown open with such violence that the leaves seemed to strike the side wall of the hall, for it was so dark without that this could only be surmised by the sound. The struggle was renewed with an agony and intenseness of energy that betrayed itself in deep-drawn gasps. One desperate effort, which terminated in the breaking of some part of the door, producing a sound as if the doorpost was wrenched from its position, was followed by another wrestle, evidently upon the narrow ledge which ran outside the door, overtopping the precipice. This proved to be the final struggle. It was followed by a crashing sound, as if some heavy body had fallen over and was rushing down the precipice through the light boughs that crossed near the top. All then became still as the grave, except when the moan of the night wind sighed upon the wooded glen. The old servant had not nerve to return through the hall, and to him the darkness seemed all but endless. But morning at length came, and with it the disclosure of the events of the night. Near the door upon the ground lay Sir Robert's sword belt, which had given way in the scuffle. A huge splinter from the massive doorpost had been wrenched off by an almost superhuman effort, one which nothing but the gripe of the despairing man could have severed, and on the rocks outside were left the marks of the slipping and sliding of feet. At the foot of the precipice, not immediately under the castle, but dragged away up the glen, were found the remains of Sir Robert, with hardly a vestige of a limb or feature left indistinguishable. The right hand, however, was uninjured, and in its fingers were clutched with the fixedness of death a long lock of coarse sooty hair, the only direct circumstantial evidence of the presence of a second person. The garden that was desolate by Ulrich Daubeny. The country to the south of Birdlip, a Cotswold eyrie close on Roman Ermine Street, is, if scarcely wild, at least bleak, austere, and sparsely populated. It is a region of prehistoric burial mounds, of straggling British trackways, of Roman roads, Norman churches, ancient farm buildings, ruinous cottages, a drywall country, sharply undulating, its bleak downs relieved by occasional secretive woods of larch or beech. In striking contrast is the Cotswold edge, precipitous drop of several hundred feet into the fertile Severn Valley, where a kaleidoscopic vista of irregularly shaped and partly colored fields spread out in a level tract for a distance of some 30 miles. Close to Birdlip, the high road skirts this edge, and there for the space of several minutes Philip Cranham lingered, watching the play of sunlight over the jagged chine of Malvern, pale and beautiful in the shimmering distance. "What a position for a house," he mused, turning reluctantly and continuing at a brisk walk, for the air on these heights is chilly even towards the end of June. His way bore to the southwest in the direction of the forgotten town of Painswick, which was to be the last stage of his tour. A lover of the unconventional in walking, Philip deserted the usual high road through the woods, striking across a strip of common and over several fields until he met a narrow lane, which promised to lead him in the right direction. Deeply rutted by former traffic, it was long since grass-grown, scattered with mossy boulders and enclosed on either side by a straggling bramble hedge. A veritable picture of desolation, thought Philip, glancing uneasily at the approaching heavy clouds, for the tremulous mutter of thunder had assailed his ears, and he looked in vain for a place of shelter. This was an upper rampart of the Cotswold, a ridge bleak and desolate, set apart from all things hospitable, where there was no course but to throw one's weight against the wind and face the threatened downpour. The lane, overgrown and serrulated, continued for some distance until, quite unexpectedly, the hedge was succeeded by a wall, dry-built, as is the custom of the district, and strengthened by a massive cornice. Philip marveled at its height, for it stood at least 12 feet. It looked to be of recent building, and still retained the bright cream color peculiar to the local limestone when freshly dug. Near the middle, the wall was broken by a gateway flanked by massive pillars on which hung double doors, palpably amateurish in construction. One of these had been unhooked and dragged into the foreclosure, where an elderly man was busy strengthening it with pieces of rough timber. "Afternoon," he volunteered, after a nervous scrutiny of Philip, who had come to a halt before the gateway. "Going to have a storm." He needed to be no prophet, for already great, bloated drops of rain were falling, heralded by resounding clap of thunder. Philip cast an apprehensive glance skywards, and commenced to unstrap his mackintosh. "Yes, we are in for it," he agreed, with the pointed addition. "Unpleasantly exposed up here. Not even a decently thick hedge to shelter under." There was a noticeable hesitation before the stranger answered, and when he did, it was with a certain shy reluctance. "Come inside. You can shelter my room until the rain stops." Philip required no second bidding. Half a dozen steps and he was viewing an extensive garden, consisting first of a rough lawn, backed by currant and gooseberry bushes, young fruit trees, a yew hedge, industriously trim, and then divers beds and footpaths, disappearing over the sloping hillside. Signs of any habitable building there were none. "Come along," enjoined the stranger, advancing hastily across the spacious lawn. "I live over there, in the lookout post." For the first time Philip noticed, built against and forming part of the left-hand boundary wall, a kind of miniature watchtower, with pyramid stone roof, terminated by a central chimney. A flight of steps led them to the doorway, for the place was built upon a mound, with floor level halfway up, and sloping roof considerably above the wall. Within there was a single room, possibly 12 feet square, having a fireplace in one corner, a narrow window cut through the outer wall, and another, a very large one, facing down the garden and over the lovely Vale of Severn. "What a glorious view!" exclaimed Philip, despite himself. "Damned view, damned view. Wish I'd never set eyes upon it." Philip turned in open-mouthed astonishment, but his companion paid no heed, though he continued in a quieter tone. "I'm a slave to that view. I can sit and look at it for hours. I worship it, yet all the while I hate it. Like to hear the story of all this?" With rather an abandoned gesture, he swept his hand about to indicate the tiny house, the garden, and the towering outer walls. "I should like to know why there are immensely high walls on three sides, or rather two, for the third is incomplete, and yet..." "To keep out undesirables, my dear sir." "To keep out undesirables," interrupted the stranger with uncontrolled impatience. "The walls and the tall gates, which I am busily strengthening." "But, excuse me," continued Philip, obstinately bent on satisfying his curiosity, "the third wall, as I say, is but partially built, while no barrier of any kind protects the bottom of the garden." A long silence ensued, broken only by the drumming of the rain upon the unceiled roof, an occasional echoing burst of thunder. Philip lounged thoughtfully near the open window, while his companion stood irresolute, chewing at his mustache, and with those close-knit brows, as if striving to recapture some elusive or forgotten memory. Presently his expression cleared, and as quickly changed to one of crafty eagerness. "Come, come, sir. Come, come. You cannot expect everything all at once. Do you know every stone of those walls? Yes, even of this house, built myself." Philip nodded encouragingly. At times the man seemed sane enough, and yet he was decidedly peculiar. "The reason for all this," he continued, repeating the gesture which embraced the whole of the surroundings, and ended with the larger window, "the reason of it all is that the view. More than 7 years ago I camped here, while on a holiday from London. After all the noise and smoke and racket, this place seemed like paradise, and the view, I simply could not tear myself away. It ended in my purchasing the land, for I had determined to erect a house here. There was some trouble with a woman, who held part as an allotment and claimed the place as hers, but she could produce no legal title, so the lawyer and I bundled her out between us. Vindictive old harridan she was." He ceased abruptly, creeping across to the rickety door, which he slowly opened, and after a stealthy glance around, closed with an exclamation of relief. Philip watched narrowly. The manner was so ridiculously furtive as to point without a doubt to lunacy. It was becoming distinctly creepy, this sheltering from a thunderstorm in the cottage of a maniac. "Where was I?" the man resumed, seating himself by the empty fireplace. "What? Ah, yes. I determined, as you say, to build a house here. 7 years ago, it was this very day, that half a dozen laborers commenced to turn the sods for the foundations. A month later, I was all alone. Nobody would work for me, though I had men up from Stroud, Gloucester, Cheltenham, finally from London. Will you credit me when I tell you that the beastly old hag who claimed the place had frightened them all away? I admit that there were several distressing accidents. The first day a man was bitten by an adder, and another crushed beneath a heavy stone cart. The Cheltenham foreman tripped up in a rabbit hole and broke a leg, and his successor suddenly went mad, but, fools, idiots, they actually believed the crude tales of the country folk, who said that the ranting old woman was a witch. They took to their heels and ran, the dirty cowards. What happened after that? They left me to build the house as best I might, and build it I swore I would, in face of Beelzebub. Witch or no witch, she did not frighten me, though often enough she came and threatened. Yes, cursed and threatened. So I started right away to build the highest wall I could, to keep her out.
Has it taken 7 years to do all this?
Yes. I could only build at intervals, for the garden had to be planted, and I practically live on its contents. In 2 years' time I hope to have the defensive wall completed, and then the ill-omened old faggot will be shut out from my property forever. But pardon me once more, insisted Philip,
bent on settling the question of the stranger's sanity. Why did you not run up a medium wall all around, sufficient to exclude unwelcome visitors, and then raise and strengthen it at your leisure? The recluse made no reply. Instead, he sprang forward. The door tore it open and halted on the threshold, quivering with rage. Facing him was a wizened, bent old woman, clad in an assortment of dirty rags, leaning heavily upon a stick. Her face was stained and wrinkled like a winter walnut, and inexpressibly malignant was the look that shot from beneath the overhanging eyebrows. "What is it, you old devil?" choked the man, his voice pitched high in apprehension. "Why do you stand gibbering at me like that?" She made no immediate answer, but pointing a skinny talon, uttered a husky chuckle. "Ha, ha, Ralph Cook. What did I tell ye? What did I tell ye? These 7 years gone. Stand back there, stand back. Don't you dare to molest me, woman." "Why don't you answer, Ralph Cook? Is that you're afraid? Or can it be that you don't remember? 7 years I give thee, 7 years," I said, "and then? Are you leaving, Ralph Cook? Leaving here this very day? No, you old fool. You won't fright me by your threats and curses. I bought this land and paid for it, and by glory, I mean to stay here in face of you or anybody." Then Ralph Cook, by all the powers, her arms were raised in vehement imprecation, but before the words could leave her lips, the man had dealt her a smashing blow across the face. She swayed helplessly for a moment and then staggered backwards, falling heavily to the ground. A sudden vivid flash of lightning transfixed the two men, but as the echoes of the thunder died away, Philip pushed through the open doorway and bounded down the steps. One glance was sufficient to convince him that the old woman's neck was broken. All stricken by the sight, he looked back to meet a pair of fiend's eyes, madmen's eyes, homicidal maniac's eyes. Then blank, unreasoning panic overtook him. He fled blindly in his terror, taking what appeared to be a different route across the garden. Here the grass grew rank, a yew hedge was pitifully unkempt, the fruit trees were old and straggling, the pathway all but indistinguishable. At last the boundary wall, but it was stained by the flight of many winters, and near a crumbling gateway lay one wooden door, rotting amid the weeds, while the other hung perilously upon its rusted hinges. When at last he checked his pace, Philip found himself in the grass-grown lane, and on looking back felt relieved that the walls of the accursed garden were no longer visible. With a memory so fresh upon him, Philip's judgment lost its normal balance. To witness, perhaps in some measure, to be a mute accomplice in the murder of an old woman by a maniac might well upset the strongest nerves, and he would not forget that his own life must have hung in fearful jeopardy. So alarming was the thought of giving evidence in the witness box that by the time Philip had reached Painswick, he was fully determined to say no word to the police. Instead, he gave himself the headlong flight, catching the late motor bus to Stroud and the evening train to London. Months went by, but although he kept in anxious touch with local news, no hint came that the murder had been detected. At times, Philip suffered considerable pangs of conscience, and on more than one occasion he was on the point of going to the police, only to be deterred by the anticipation of considerable official censure for so long concealing knowledge of the crime. Later his engagement and then the happiness of marriage put a period to further vain recriminations, but the memory of that awful afternoon, a secret even from his wife, was seldom from him. 2 years passed before he again set foot in Cotswold, this time with his wife and sister, viewing the romantic beauty of the district from a comfortable motor. It had been entirely Philip's proposition, this revisiting of scenes with which he had been familiar since youth, and if the suggestion had not entirely sprung from sentiment, the other reason was such that he refused to admit it, even to himself. It fell out that they stayed a while at Painswick, and then it was that Philip, throwing further self-deception to the winds, determined to satisfy his pent-up curiosity. Explaining that he wished to make inquiries of an old acquaintance, they one day motored over, approaching the garden from the direction by which he had so precipitately left it. A passable road led past the entrance to the grass-grown lane, and there, near a cottage, they drew up. Philip, in a happy moment of inspiration, crossed to the cottage with a view to making some discreet inquiries. A typical Cotswold woman answered to his knock, tanned and healthy, but prematurely gray. "Good afternoon," he greeted her. "Can you tell me anything about the house? That is, the garden up the lane?" "Mr. Ralph Cook, I think, was the owner's name," he added, seeing that the woman preserved a stolid silence. "I'll ask Father to come," she answered, regarding him with questioning eyes. "Will you step inside, sir?" Philip followed into the neatly furnished parlor and was presently joined by a corduroyed rustic, very old and lame. "Ralph Cook?" repeated the latter, becoming acquainted with the business. "Yes, sir, I can tell ye zummit about he. To be sure I can. Ralph Cook, or Cook's Folly, we called him, aye. And full he were right enough, when he tried to be upsides o' Mother Gaskin. 'Twere a bad day for he when he went up there. Zero no mistake, not but what Alice said as how." "Is the building complete?" ventured Philip, breaking in upon the old fellow's ponderous garrulity. "Are the walls finished?" "No, he, of course not. She seed to that, bless ye. Why, I can yet mind the day, sir, when he began a building. 6 men he brought with him. And what of that? One were crushed beneath the wagon. Another broke his leg. The foreman?" "Yes, yes, I know about that. What I really wanted to ask was of Mr. Cook himself. Is he still living there?" The old man glared at Philip in open-mouthed astonishment. "Still there?" he at last gasped. "Lord's sakes, ain't he old enough to be my own father when he came back more'n 40 years back?" "What do you mean, 40 years? Mr. Cook told me that he had been there about 7. He told you?" "Yes, don't you understand? I was here the summer before last and had a long conversation with him." Instead of making a direct reply, the old man shuffled to the door and called his daughter. His voice was distinctly tremulous when he began to question her. "Polly, can you mind the time when Ralph Cook were living up at the Folly?" "Why, no, father," she replied, obviously puzzled. "You know, I wasn't born then. Not till several years later." "And you be about 34 now, ain't ye? This here gentleman. But no matter, Polly. You can run along." Left alone, the two men regarded each other in moody silence. "What became of him?" asked Philip presently. "Hung himself. Leastways, so 'twere said. But people do hold as to how Mother Gaskin did for him. She always was a rum one, was Mother Gaskin. Folks don't rightly know what became of her, though. Some thought she went off a-riding upon her broomstick and got took up into the moon. Of course, that ain't rightly possible, leastways, not to my way of thinking." There was no more to be learnt, so Philip, curiously unconvinced, hurried back toward the motor. This was empty, and realizing that the girls had wandered off alone, he decided to seize the opportunity and put an end to further doubt by private personal investigation. Accordingly, he set off up the lane, ruminating all the while on the extraordinary tale he had just heard. Could the old man have been weak-witted? And was he backed up by his daughter merely to preserve appearances before a stranger? It seemed quite probable, more probable than that he must disbelieve the evidence of his own senses. Yes, of course. How could he have doubted? There ahead of him stood the garden wall, bright and new, looking in the massive dry-built gateway, with one door still unhooked. A few steps more, and he had come to a standstill before the familiar entrance. "Afternoon," greeted an elderly man, who was working mending the dismantled gate with a piece of odd timber. "Going to have a storm?" A heavy echo of thunder came, as if to confirm his supposition, and then the rain began to fall, in isolated, swollen drops. "Yes, we are in for it," Philip found himself repeating as a person in a dream. "Unpleasantly exposed appear, not even—" Then he was running, racing madly away from the accursed spot. Horror in its most primitive form pursued him, and he fled until, soaked with perspiration and painfully short of breath, he found himself clambering on board the waiting motor. Presently his wife and sister came into view, approaching from the entrance to the grass-grown lane. Both were somewhat breathless and a trifle pale. "Oh, Philip," the former panted as soon as they had reached the motor, We found such a hard place. Joy suggested walking up that lane just to see where it led, and we came across a kind of deserted garden surrounded by enormous walls. They looked old and dilapidated, and there was a tumble-down gateway. Oh, all so sad and dreary. Everything inside was wild and overgrown, and there was a curious little house built against the wall, which looked as if it had not been touched for years. Suddenly, as we were wandering around, we both had an impression that somebody was watching us. I don't know why, but it gave us the horrors, and we simply had to run. What is the matter, dear? You look quite ill. Oh, nothing. Perhaps the thunder. It was quite a heavy clap. When? We heard nothing. Have you seen your friend? Yes. No, I mean, he has left this neighborhood. Shall we be making a move homeward?